You are listening to Finding Psychotherapy with me, Carla Vicorissa. In this series, I'll be speaking to a range of highly experienced mental health practitioners, asking them to explain in simple terms what they do, how they do it, and why is it therapeutic. I would also be asking them to give you a few tips of when to seek support, and when you do, how to find what's right for you. This is a podcast to help us think about mental health, what it means, and how we can begin to navigate this complicated, often mysterious, and fascinating world. Daniel Maria is an accredited CBT consultant, senior lecturer, researcher, and writer who trained and worked with some of the most recognizable clinicians in the United States and the UK. He has trained and worked alongside Donald Meichenbaum, considered by most to be the Freud of CBT therapy, and the author of Roadmap to Resilience, Sarah Corrie, author of The Art of Living, Mark Davis, principal of the UK College of Cognitive Behavioural Hypnosis, Paul Gilbert, better known for his research on compassion, and Marsha Lanehan, who created dialectical behavioural therapy. Daniel Maria currently researches and expands his own treatment model called Neuroaffective CBT. He writes articles, workshops, doctoral programs, and trains in different cognitive and behavioral approaches, such as exposure therapy, stress inoculation, cognitive restructuring, metacognitive therapy, high and low intensity CBT, CB hypnotherapy, EMDR, mindfulness therapy, DBT, and ACT. With a career spanning over 30 years in the mental health field, he is a fellow alumni of King's College and an accredited practitioner with the BABCP and UKCP, as well as a senior associate for the Royal Society of Medicine, IACP and EMDR Association for the UK and Ireland. Having a particular interest in low self-esteem, childhood trauma, and deeply rooted feelings of shame and guilt, Daniel Maria developed his own behavioural model called Neuroaffective CBT, focused on earlier traumas, shame, and self-loathing. Daniel Maria works as a medical legal expert with trauma victims of terror incidents, violence, or work-related accidents, but at the other end of the spectrum, also with professional athletes or personalities from within the London arts, theatre, and media community, looking to enhance and improve performance. Daniel, welcome, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us today about CBT.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for taking the time. So our point to this podcast is to tell our viewers a little bit more about CBT therapy, how it might be helpful to them, what they might be looking for, and hopefully you can answer these questions for us in simple terms.
Okay, sounds good to me.
So what is CBT? We hear about it a lot out there, but I feel that it's not that easy to understand exactly what it is.
It isn't, and I'll try to hopefully bring some light onto this rather complex form of psychotherapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy stands for psychological treatment. It's probably the only form of evidence-based psychological treatment that's approved in the Western Hemisphere, so United Kingdom, Western Europe, US and Canada, and so on. Now, of course, the evidence has been increasing, and it favored this type of approach simply because of the enormous research and funding that has gone into this type of therapy. And this is where things are getting a little bit complicated, because we're not talking about one approach. CBT is, in fact, and stands for cognitive behavioral therapies, rather, and it is an umbrella term for a number of different approaches. For instance, ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, neuroaffective CBT is my own method of treatment. But they all have one thing in common, which is the focus on problem solving, installing new coping strategies, helping the individual learn. So helping individuals who suffer from a mental disorder or a complex emotional disorder helping them learn new skills. You could say that the goals of cognitive behavioral therapy is to help an individual who has fallen in the trap of mental illness to become self-efficient and independent and learn to manage symptoms of mental illness more efficiently in a way that promotes their own personal goals and values.
So CBT is an umbrella term for many different types of therapy. What really sets it apart is that it's measurable, which is quite unique in the sort of psychotherapeutic world, because normally it's quite hard to determine what's successful and what's not. And it actually gives you some tools that you can use in your life once you've understood your behavior to manage your distress, your emotions, your feelings.
That's correct, Carla. CBT, in essence, is nothing but a combination, if you like, of different strategies, different techniques that the individual takes from the therapy, from this safe therapeutic space, and applies them into their own environment in order to improve their situation. So best way to think about some of those interventions is probably if we were to split them into four or even five categories. We have cognitive interventions or mind interventions, things like being aware of your own thoughts, paying attention to your mind and what your mind is saying from time to time, learning to look at the evidence for and against certain thoughts that we have, learning to, if necessary, challenge these thoughts, learning to no longer suppress, neutralize, or attempt to just get rid of thoughts who are just normal products of our mind. We cannot achieve that. So understanding how our mind and prefrontal abilities, our brain, if you like, operates when we are under duress or in a crisis. Those would be cognitive interventions. Then we also have a range of behavioral interventions, such as exposure therapies, where we assist people with their fears towards a specific stimulus. Say, for instance, you've been bitten by a dog and you are afraid of going into your local park because there are a lot of dog walkers there. In such cases, we might help individuals reclaim that that park and that walk. So we're helping them respond to a need that they do have, rather than give in to this trap that such a phobia would lie for them. So exposure therapies is about gradually helping people return to normal activities that they used to enjoy in the past, but because of a trauma, for a better word, or an unhappy, unfortunate event, they no longer engage with certain activities and they withdraw. When we fear something, we withdraw. Avoidance is a natural response. Again, this is something else that we need to help people understand. Mm-hmm. Normalize whatever it is that they're going through. But at the same time, if their wish is to change that behavior and to continue to enjoy that park, rather than not, then this is where we can help. So that would fall under behavioral interventions. There are other interventions as well, of course, that would fall under the chapter of problem solving or indeed life coaching or experiential interventions, which would be much more about learning how to breathe, how to relax, how to pay attention to different to your body, to understand how your body reacts psychosomatically or unconsciously, for a better word, when it's under duress, when it's faced with a perceived threat. So a range of relaxation exercises, focusing exercises, attention training exercises. The term that's popular these days and commonly used would be mindfulness. Mindfulness is in fact, is a cognitive behavioral tool that has evolved in the late 80s, early 90s. The name of the therapy is called MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, or MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which consists of a series of attention training and progressive muscle relaxation and breathing exercises. So it's fascinating domain to get into. So you see lots of different interventions depending on what the individual needs.
Exactly. And what feels so important to me about all this is that it's tangible. So it's growing an awareness. It's giving you tools, active tools that you can use in your life to manage things better. And that's so unique, I feel, to CBT and the CBT umbrella.
I would agree with you, but this is the scope of cognitive behavioral therapy from day one, ever since it's evolved in the 60s as a mere treatment for depression. In its infancy, CBT was nothing but a treatment protocol for depression. And just to bracket at this point, CBT has always been about treating and treatment. It's always been symptoms focused. It is always people that have traditionally used to train in CBT were either coming from a psychiatric background, so psychiatrists or psychiatric nurses, or from psychology background, usually clinical psychologists, counseling psychologists. So you have to have a core profession. That's in fact the best way. And this is what would help you identify competent CBT therapists. I don't know if we get a chance to talk about competencies and how to get hold of a CBT therapist at some point. Probably a separate discussion. But there are good reasons for this, because the CBT therapist has to have an in-depth understanding of psychopathology. So in-depth knowledge of psychiatry, they have to be able to diagnose the problem. Now, even if that means that we eliminate the possibility of, so for instance, self-diagnosis is very common these days. A lot of people have understood. Yeah, and it's a big problem for us. A lot of people have understood, and a lot of people have figured out the CBT is kind of treatment, and we go to a CBT therapist if we want to kind of improve rather rapidly or change something in our lives or deal with some symptoms that I cannot handle by myself. So quite often they do a lot of research and let's say self-diagnose. And of course, this is a problem for us because that just complicates matters. They can take the therapist, the counselor, if you do indeed lack knowledge of psychopathology and psychiatry, they can set you off in the wrong direction. That is why it is essentially called the behavioral therapy, that we are psychiatrically trained, that we do understand mental disorders, and we can diagnose almost as competently as a psychiatrist would, if not even better. Not to mention that a large part of the CBT community have an actual, you know, people are already, the core profession would be psychiatry in the first place or psychiatric nursing. So that makes things easier. But yeah, there is this issue of being able to recognize a mental illness or a mental disorder and prescribe the appropriate treatment plan and treatment tools. Because if I know you're suffering from a borderline personality disorder, I not only have to be able to diagnose that, but match it with the right treatment program that has been proven to work. In this case, for instance, dialectical behavioral therapy, and that and the combination of trauma-focused CBT would be ideal for the treatment of borderline personality disorder. But to get there, you'd have to be able to diagnose the condition in the first place.
Yeah, and that feels so important as well about all of this is self-diagnosis and how difficult and tricky that can be. But under the CBT umbrella, there is also this idea, which is closer to the medical model, as you're saying, to make an assessment, to understand the problem, to be able to diagnose the problem efficiently and effectively and have a treatment plan based on that. And that's what makes it easier to quantify, to understand, to see what the successes are, what the failures are of the treatment itself, and that's quite unique to this, I feel.
Yes, I think all these models that come under the umbrella of CBT operate on one simple principle, which I would summarize with three acronyms: ACT. That doesn't come from acceptance and commitment therapy; comes from assess, conceptualize, and treat.
Yeah,
that's essentially what we do. Yeah. We're all rooted in this process. That is the process. This is what one should expect from an experienced or an accredited cognitive behavioral therapist. You will go through an assessment, which sounds more formal than it is in reality. The scope of that assessment is to arrive at a diagnosis, but a much more formulaic diagnosis. So a formula, a conclusion, if you like, of your assessment. And this conceptualization sometimes are represented by in a diagram or a formula as such, describing a range of mechanisms. You know, this is given your early experiences. It is clear that you have internalized those early experiences in a negative fashion. And as a result of this early experiences and the core beliefs, the schemas that have evolved since, you have compensated for it in a particular way. And these behaviors, these overcompensatory behaviors, these avoidant behaviors, these self-sabotaging behaviors, those are the behaviors that we will address in therapy, which in turn will have a domino effect on your core beliefs, on these schemas, on how you truly view the world and yourself. So this addresses, if I may add, one of the myths that somehow CBT is just a plaster on a wound rather than looking deep at issues. It's just simply not the case. Like any other type of psychotherapy, it's impossible to treat, to help an individual move on if you don't understand, if you can't connect the dots and you can't leave out childhood. You can't leave out that parenting, early experiences in school, an individual's first love, and so on and so forth. You can't just bypass all these early experiences, which could be responsible for the way, more than likely are responsible for how you feel today or how.
Well, it's looking at things into context, and CBT does it in a structured way to then come up with a treatment plan. So who might benefit from coming to CBT?
Well, it's an interesting question. I truly believe that anyone can benefit, but there's a condition attached to that in the people that feel they want to have some CBT treatment or experience this approach. They should definitely make sure that they are being seen by a fully accredited CBT therapist, somebody at a senior level, at a consultant level, with some experience. Not the junior CBT therapists are not experienced enough. Of course, they are, and they could be very competent as long as they are also accredited. And what makes things rather complicated in UK is the fact that we have different levels of competency or accreditation, level one, level two, and so on. So I think it's best if you aim for someone that's fully accredited and has a core profession.
So for someone who wants to look for some CBT therapy and a therapist, where would they go? Where would you recommend they go and look for one?
I think the BABCP register is ideal. If you are registered with several boards or certification boards or accrediting organizations like myself, I'm triple certified. Maybe more. I'm registered with UKCP. I'm accredited and accredited by them, accredited by BABCP, registered with BPS, Senior Associate. And usually I get very suspicious when I see a name with lots of acronyms behind that name. For some reason, maybe it's just me, but unfortunately I fall in that category too. but, you know, it comes with experience, I guess. This is not always a bad thing. It is important that your therapist is an accredited therapist with BABCP. If they have an accreditation with other organization also, then that's fantastic. That just shows they have more experience and they can rely on their expertise.
That's very good advice. And thank you. How much would you expect to pay for a CBT session?
This is the bad news. An experienced CBT therapist charges, they will not charge less than £80 per hour. In my experience, really, the minimum is 100. and it goes up to 150 per hour. So some therapists offer concessions to students or people who are unemployed, but even those concessions are in the region of £80 per hour. But what you should be getting in return is someone with an experience, someone kind, empathic, who is not just able to listen to your story, but should be able to help you make sense of everything that's going on and essentially diagnose the vulnerability, diagnose the problem. Not only that, but also suggest a way forward, a treatment plan. We go back to ACT, assess, conceptualize, and treat, which really just stands for we're assessing, we're diagnosing, and then we're offering a treatment plan. At the very least, if your therapist is qualified, and accredited, then they should be able to offer that. And sometimes, in some cases, that the treatment part is largely self-help. So you will be doing a lot of the work in your own environment. So in that sense, although the hourly rates can be quite expensive, you do get eventually value for money, because the goal is your independence, self-efficacy, helping the individual apply these tools in their own environment and gradually allowing them to do that work in their own environment. And hopefully that happens in a shorter period of time. I wouldn't say 4, 5, or 6 sessions is our programs promoted by NHS. We all know NHS, it's an organization that's under tremendous pressure with long waiting lists. And therefore, yes, they do offer CBT. Their therapists are very competent. However, there are service constraints. You know, they're limited in their offer. What happens in private practice, the therapy tends to go on for a little bit longer. So I would expect, but longer doesn't mean years, it means months.
Three to
12 months, I would say, and the average would be 6 months of therapy.
And that's how I understand CBT as well, to be it's not long-term, never-ending for years and years and years. There's a treatment plan, so there's a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Exactly. Yeah. It's goal-oriented and symptoms-focused. Once these goals are reached and the symptoms diminish, then there's no reason for us to continue the treatment. And in that sense, it becomes measurable as well, because we use throughout the process a range of different scales to keep track of where the individual is at and their progress.
And I feel for a client, there's something very reassuring. I think there's something for all of us that we're used to the medical system. So we're used to going to see a doctor, get a treatment plan, and hopefully see a result at the end of it. It doesn't always happen that way, but that's sort of what's in the back of our minds. So I feel that there's something incredibly reassuring about CBT and this approach that CBT has to a problem, because it's confined. And that's a bit like a security blanket, I feel. There's something about open-ended therapy and talking therapy that can feel a bit sort of hard to grasp, a bit abstract.
Absolutely. And this is, I suppose, one of the advantages of working within a cognitive behavioral framework. You work towards specific goals, and your ultimate goal is becoming not happier. Nobody can guarantee that, but more efficient. More functional, able to maybe more confident in certain situations that you felt perhaps you could not handle in the past. If you are dealing with somebody that is feeling helpless, then you can imagine that it's at a gut feeling, and they're not even aware to begin with that could well be the roots of their depression or this overwhelming sense of pessimism and lack of energy and sleepless nights and so on, internal self-criticism, self-blaming thoughts. Most people, they just feel lousy. They feel depressed. They feel sad. They don't really fully understand what's going on. And to come to someone that can help you see that, you know, this is just an episode of depression, and it doesn't have to be the end of the world. This is what depression does to people. And this is This is how you could manage those symptoms. And this is how you can come out of it. So we can measure that. We can keep track of those, of that progress.
And that's just so powerful.
Yeah, I feel it gives people hope, and
absolutely,
from a position of feeling helpless. And it also, it eliminates the hook, the mystery that mental illness has over us. You know, it's like a hook. It's trapping us into this mysterious kind of unhappiness, you know, that we don't just, why is it that I'm feeling? You're a therapist. I mean, you've seen a lot of patients or clients coming to you. It's, why is this always happening to me? What is going on? Why am I feeling how I'm feeling? You know, all the whys, it's painful, right? It's painful. It hurts. CBT has often been blamed for adopting the position of an expert, for being directing and acting like coaches and teachers sometimes. That's exactly what we do. But we have no evidence. We see no evidence that people do not, you know, people that suffer from mental illness do not want to engage with us in that way, do not want to learn about their condition, about what's going on. In a non-judgmental space where you're not going to be criticized for how you feel. But on the contrary, it's okay to feel the way you feel. In fact, you have a few pretty bad habits there, including self-criticism, this internal critical voice. And let's try and find a history of all that. Where is that coming from? And if it's coming from there, great. We're not going to stop there. We want to resolve it somehow. We want to answer back. We want to stand up to that inner critic and say, hey, that's it. I'm not going to put up with you anymore. I'm ready to move on now.
So it's growing an awareness and understanding and having that curiosity for oneself and then confronting it and trying to find a way to deal with it.
Forward. And this is where we equip our clients or patients with the right tools. That inner self-talk or self-to-self dialogue, so important have an honest, assertive, confident dialogue with your vulnerable self, with your critical self, with your guilty self. With that side of you that's kind of representing something old and long gone, you know, maybe the critical voice of a parent who felt at that time that you were underperforming in school. I mean, I'm a parent. I feel my son doesn't always perform well in school. it's things happen to us. Bad things always happen to good people. It's not always intentional. But it's about us resolving these internal issues. And when you have this external, objective, kind therapist that can give you some tools, that can get in there with you through collaboration, through therapeutic alliance and therapeutic bond, we can fight these internal struggles together. That's a hell of a thing.
And that's what it is. That's what it's all about.
That's what it's all about, you know? and that's why people actually love CBT. But I can also understand the criticism, because from the outside, without experiencing these issues, the way CBT is presented often to the world as a very directive method, we are experts, we make clinical judgments all the time, we're kind of positioning ourselves differently from the rest of the psychotherapeutic community. And everyone else is like, what are you people doing? This is like borderline unethical. We don't direct. We don't tell our clients what to do. You know, we don't.
It's different.
It's different because it's treatment. It's a different paradigm. I'm not criticizing any other schools of thoughts here. Far from it. They all have a place. I've studied lots of different therapies. I stayed with CBT because I decided to offer treatment to my clients or my patients. And my position in the mental health sector as one as such that demands that type of approach, psychological treatment. I have to be goal-oriented. I have to be symptoms-focused, and I have to direct, I have to instruct, I have to guide, and I have to teach.
And that leads me into my next question. So what can I expect if I'm going to go and see a CBT therapist? What could I expect from a session? So I could expect some direction.
Exactly. So I would go back to what I said earlier, assess, conceptualize, and treat. So expect to begin with a process that can be quite tiring, where you sit down with someone that's knowledgeable, someone that understands psychiatric conditions and is going to look out for signs of a serious or a diagnosable mental disorder, only to eliminate possibilities, to make sure that you don't suffer from, you don't have an obsessive compulsive disorder or a personality disorder. So, and if you don't, and you then and your problem falls in between cracks, which often does, not all problems, all struggles are diagnosable. And then we formulate that. And how do we do that? It's by understanding all the predisposing mechanisms, all the covert, the hidden mechanisms that are maintaining or have maintained this vulnerability over the years. So that's what you should expect within the first sort of couple of hours, 3 hours of therapy, those initial sessions. Mm. Someone that's really curious and interested in your struggles, someone that's going to ask you a lot of questions, someone that has patience and compassion, and will listen to the story that you're willing to share with us, but will also keep an eye on the stuff that you're maybe not so willing to share with us, and will gently guide you through that narrative in order to come up with a solution, with a treatment. So, for instance, quite often we would be visiting some of the early experiences only to understand, as I explained earlier, how the victim, how the individual who is now a victim of trauma, for instance, has internalized those early experiences. And if they started feeling about themselves at an early age that they are worthless, that the world is unsafe, and significant others are unlikely to take advantage of them if given a chance, then, well, that's something that needs to be noted. That's something that we need to work with therapeutically. And that's what will happen in the first few stages of therapy. Try to make some connections between early experiences and how one feels inside about themselves, significant others, and the world, their core beliefs, if you like, only to then understand the reinforcing mechanisms, the vicious circles, the traps, the shoulds and the musts. Oh, if I feel inside useless, how am I going to navigate through life with this knowledge? Mm. Well, I'll make sure that I'll be the best friend that I can be. I always have to make myself available. I should always deliver at 100% level. When I'm at work, I should always complete my projects on time at 100%. Well, that may not be sustainable. And when you fail, or when you get it right only at 80 or 90% level, you end up feeling useless again. So these are just traps reinforcing this gut feeling, this sense of self that you are useless. Mm. And those would be targeted in therapy, not just the core beliefs, but also the reinforcing mechanisms, the underlying assumptions, all the shoulds and musts.
Mm. So the first few sessions, one could expect a therapist who's kind, who's empathic, and who's ultimately curious about you and understanding you, your history, your context, how you perceive the world and how you make sense of it for yourself. And things perhaps right. That you're not aware of and that you might not have picked up on. With that in hand, the therapist will then think about the do's, shoulds and the triggers and what you yep. shouldn't do, and come up with techniques to help you see these things and help you think about how to manage yeah. them. And that's the treatment. And then there's a conclusion at the end.
That would be the treatment plan, which will then be followed by a relapse prevention stage, or what I often refer to like a revolving door. You know, you don't just suddenly cut someone off, but you spread the sessions out, you see, and you look out for their ability to put in practice everything that they gain therapeutically. You see them only once a month. Maybe other things have come up. We look at our therapeutic gains or therapy, what we've learned in therapy, how could we put that in practice in response to this new issue that has arisen, and so on and so forth. So that would be the relapse prevention stage, the final stage of the treatment. But all stages are important, and the client would never feel that they're going through stages. They'll just turn up, and that's really all we need for the client to turn up and be interested in going on this journey with a therapist, in traveling down this particular road. Everything else we're there to essentially assist them with and collaboratively achieve. But yeah, that's how I would probably summarize the process of CBT. You do, even though you don't feel that you're going through this almost prescribed stages, you're just having a conversation and about your earlier years, and then how does that impact on my current difficulties? Now that we understand these connections, what could we possibly do in between these sessions about various difficulties that we might encounter at work and or in our private lives? How could we act differently? When we talk about behavioral and social experiments, there will be lots of experiments that will play out.
And that's the thing I think that's also important to keep in mind when thinking about what a session could look like. So there might be breathing exercises, there might be going outside for exposure therapy and exposing yourself to the thing that you're fearful of, or experimenting in social situations. So it's much more proactive in that way, and one should expect that.
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, if you're diagnosed with a clear-cut disorder, which often is the case, say you have a panic disorder, then usually somebody that suffered from panics, they are afraid of their symptoms, of natural symptoms of anxiety. So they would be afraid of feeling panic in their body, feeling the sensations of anxiety. And as a result, they will always be hyper-aroused and tense, always hyper-vigilant, making sure that they don't stress the body too much. They'll stay away from certain situations, from traveling too far, for example, so that one doesn't trigger any symptoms of anxiety. Because if I do, then that will harm me somehow, or I could have a heart attack, or I could faint and hurt my head in the process and eventually die. So people have all sorts of catastrophical thoughts when they suffer from panic disorder. And that's just an example. We will not just deal in the room with catastrophical thinking and teach people how to decatastrophize their thinking, but we would also design a thorough exposure plan of managing situations that they think they cannot manage, going to shopping by themselves, having an anxiety attack on the street. What would that look like? At first, you induce that with your therapist, for instance. So we expose people to a variety of situations that are likely to trigger anxiety. This is called situational exposures. But what we also do, with panic in particular, we expose people to symptoms of anxiety, heart beating, sweating, palpitations, and so on, that people associate with some sort of catastrophe, usually death or heart attack, and so on. This is called interoceptive exposures. So it's a process that's a little bit more complicated, and it might even sound scary to someone who suffers from panic, but really it's just, in a very safe and contained environment, we induce symptoms of anxiety and we teach people how to self-regulate, how to breathe, how to think, how to manage this distress inside their body without going into a full panic attack.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for telling us a little bit about CBT, how it works. I think it's going to be really helpful to people out there to hear about it and to understand it a little bit better. Thank you very much for everything today. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And thank you again for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Finding Psychotherapy by me, Carla Vacoysa. I always love to engage with my listeners, so if you have any thoughts, questions, or queries, I would love to hear from you. You can find me on Instagram on Finding Psychotherapy. This podcast has been edited by Iceni Studios, and the music is by David Rhodes.